transformational change. Real people, real pain, real hopelessness, real healing. Witness firsthand the challenges that men and women from around the world faced head on, and how through their adversity they became stronger and happier. Battling a life-threatening illness, surviving an abusive relationship, overcoming addiction, suffering the heartbreaking loss of a child, wrestling with self-sabotaging thoughts, losing and finding love. These are just a few of the transformational stories that will encourage you and change your perspective in chaos to clarity. A global voice of the contributing authors bears their souls for you. Their unfettered honesty is a gift to all and connects us to the butterfly effect of universal oneness. Just as the flapping of a tiny wing can change weather patterns around the world, a small inspiration may impart positively on another's life. The tears shed from these stories may make waves on distant shores, and your peals of laughter may become someone's breath of life. Change is part of the natural order of life. In this inspirational book, authors Caganello and Canevas offer their expertise on the spirituality and psychology of change and explain why change is not only necessary, it's good for you. Welcome to the heart of our shared humanity. Discover hope for the future and a blueprint for your life in these life-changing pages. I'm Richard Dugan, your host on this special edition, a month-long look at the book, Chaos to Clarity. The entire month is devoted to authors from this book to help you and encourage you. Stay tuned. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And keep this in mind. I have declared the year 2020, the year of perfect vision. So, let's go from chaos to clarity. Let's go from change to perfect vision here in 2020. The entire month of January, stay with us here on Tell Me Your Story. Now, let's go find out about change in chaos to clarity. I want to welcome to our program today one of the contributors to this particular work, which I have been looking at and reading through some of these stories. Mel Greenberg, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story.
Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for having me.
And of course, most of our listeners know this program. Normally, I go through a long litany of details, sort of housekeeping regarding the program and all of that. But we're going to forego that on this particular program because I want to dive right into this subject because I think that it's very important for our listeners. Now, one of the aspects, and we're going to go primarily into, to start out with, the stories that you have contributed, and you've contributed one. How many stories did you contribute to this particular work?
One.
Just the one. And it's entitled Two Words, if I'm not mistaken.
It is.
And they are two words that most people haven't heard. However, most people will probably be able to connect with the meaning of those words, the backstory, so to speak.
Sure.
I have never had to deal with this subject until I met and married my second wife and went through a series of months of dealing with this, and I've shared with our listeners about it on the program. And you, in your story, two words, surviving my worst nightmare, liberated me. What I find interesting is how, through the process, which we will have you describe, you came to a place which seems rather strange to be able to come to a place where you felt that what you had taken on or had been given, however you want to phrase that, was a blessing. That you were blessed by this. And that's really what these stories in Chaos to Clarity are about. So tell us about your story, which certainly we want people to pick up a copy of the book Chaos to Clarity. But give us a little background on you and how you came to this particular place where you heard these two words.
Well, shall I share the two words?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. So I came to the place where I was the daughter of a breast cancer recipient, if you will. I hate to use the word victim. And it was my mother, and she passed just a week before her 50th birthday, and I was just 17. And what came from that was a lifetime of first of all, awareness that others may not have, and then also of fear, and that turned into anxiety that her fate was my sealed fate. And through a lifetime of that and dealing with it and then getting it, I came to this conclusion and ended up here, where in fact it actually was a blessing. It was kind of the veil removed from fear, and it was empowering because I no longer feared the unknown, and I saw in myself and with the support of my tremendous family just how strong you can be in the middle of adversity.
That seems to be a result of a process that we all seem to go through. We all get tossed into these scenarios where we didn't maybe consciously ask for them, but there they are. And mm-hmm. it's something that now it's like, okay, how do I process this?
Right.
I know that for myself and my wife, I had never been a caregiver before. I didn't even know what that was at the time. And rather ironically, a few years later, after we moved to Santa Barbara, I was producing a program dealing specifically with the subject of caregivers. And then I began to understand. And it turns out that you can be a caregiver in a lot of different ways. I'm curious as to the people around you at the time of the diagnosis and the utterance of these two words by your doctor, who also, if I'm correct, was a female doctor, female oncologist.
Yes, yes.
What was the response of the people around you at that time, family, friends, and so forth?
Well, my family obviously was aware of my family history, and I have two boys. And at the time, my oldest, who's now 27, was a freshman in high school, was going to be a senior in high school. And my youngest, who will be 25 next week, was in the eighth grade. So they were aware of it, quite aware of my family history. And the way that I dealt with it was to, once we knew, I shared it with my husband, and we dealt with it that through the day. And then that evening we sat our family down and talked with them openly and honestly, because I didn't want them to fear the unknown as I had. And they were with me every step of the way. For the first few appointments, my husband went, I literally put together my team of doctors, as I liken it to putting together a coaching staff. My husband played college football. We're very involved in that. My youngest son played at Kentucky. And I likened it to putting together a coaching staff. And that meant going out into the community. And I'm very blessed I'm in Tucson, Arizona. And the Arizona Cancer Center is a phenomenal facility. And at any rate, what I'm trying to say is it was a lot of different medical facilities that I brought together under one umbrella. And that doesn't always happen. And with insurance being what it is nowadays, they don't like you to necessarily do that. But I think it was very important. And my husband supported me in those difficult choices, because it was important that I it wasn't, I don't, you know, everyone is the best at what they do on some level, but it has to be a fit for you emotionally, because it is an incredibly traumatic time, especially those first early months. And I was also blessed. One of my oldest son's classmates' mother was actually in development for the cancer center, and her father came, I believe it was from Chile, was one of the early developers of the cancer center in breast cancer. And I took my diagnosis to her actually right after I left the doctor's office, before I even went to my husband. And she said, everything about your life changes now. There was yesterday when cancer was a different part of your life, and there's today, and forever you will be someone who has had cancer. And how you choose to envelop that is up to you. And I really took those words to heart, because, and it is really what brought me to this point in my life today, and the opportunity to write and share my story, was that, as you said so eloquently, we are thrown things that we have no control over. Life has its way with us, and that's what we get. And it is our choice, and we do have control over how we process, how we feel about what happens to us. And taking that kind of proactive approach for me was the right way to go through this positively. And that's an easy thing too. No judgment on how, I think the most important thing we have to give ourselves is how we go through it is up to us. And no one else's opinion does matter. And that's where I found that my family was the most supportive. They stood behind me. They were my pillars in all my choices, in guidance, in offering information, in doing their own research and giving it to me, not saying this is how you have to do it, but so that I could add to the layers of my work to work through what ultimately is a very personal experience.
No question about it. And actually, my wife's experience obviously became mine, and actually facilitated the book that I am talking to people about in terms of choices. One of the things that I like about the opening, and, you know, you always want to start a story. I remember in school they taught us how to write a story. And if you don't grab them within the first sentence or two, they're never going to go further than that. And yours is along the lines of, it was a dark and stormy night, only in this case, it was a hot day in July. It was much like any other summer day in Tucson, until it wasn't. Now, if that doesn't grab you, I don't know what else will. I was born and raised in Phoenix, so I know about hot. Yes, I know about hot. But I didn't know about hot when it came to dealing with someone with in my wife's case, a rare form of fallopian tube cancer. And she went through the surgery, and she went through the chemo, which I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. It is awful. And it also facilitated the question, and I ask this question of you: when you received this diagnosis, were you able to answer? Obviously, you were able to answer in the affirmative. You know, Amel, do you want to live or do you want to die? You know, I may not like your choice, but, you know, I'll support you in whatever decision you make. Was that something that you actually had to grapple with?
Gosh, you know, the way that you just phrased it, no, I never thought of it in that term or in that way. I think maybe because of my history and what had turned into just an anxiety-ridden youth and or young adulthood, I should say, and the fear of it. Once I got it, I was like, I just knew that regardless whether I did or not, I would do what I could, how I could, to have the best life I could. And I never thought of it in terms of death. I always thought of it in terms of how to live my best life. And now that I could actually proactively handle that was the most empowering time for me. In fact, and I just had this conversation with a fellow breast cancer survivor, you know, as October brings this up, of course, for so many of us. Maybe the most curious time of that part of my journey was once I was blessed. I had a lumpectomy and radiation only. It was a very early stage. And again, I was very blessed. So once that radiation was over, in the weeks that transpired, that's when I felt the most helpless. I thought, well, I've done everything. I mean, I had spent all this time doing everything, you know, being active and proactive in my existence. And then all of a sudden it was back to, now what do I do? And there was a point of not depression, but real soul searching. Like I thought, well, if I don't eat something right, you know, there was questioning, am I going to get it again? Am I not doing something? Should I be doing something else? And I think that was the hardest time for me to work through. Mm-hmm. And until then I got back to how I felt when I heard those two words and what that meant to me. And I always go back to that when I start to question or feel out of control, because in those moments I thought, okay, this is the gate. It is opened. Here I go. And that's how I approach everything in my life now. But I have, you know, sometimes I'm there more easily than others, as with anything else.
There were two other words that came along after the fact that I have to say, epitomized, I think, the answer to that question. And even though you never addressed it directly, you sort of answered it in this fashion. And it's almost along the lines of the song by Billy Joel, My Life. This is my life. And you took those two words and turned everything around.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
So where are you today in regards to this? Now, how many years out are you?
I am a decade. August 25th, it was 10 years.
Congratulations. That is
Thank
a milestone
you.
Because at that point, they say, at that particular point, I think it's 5 years, then 10 years, and obviously mm-hmm. every day after that, you know, it's the odds are in your favor that you will live to be 95 or 100 years of age.
Yes.
Assuming that's what you want to do.
Exactly.
In terms of what you were doing at that time, okay? As the diagnosis, so to speak, the verdict was rendered. What were you doing then, and how did this diagnosis change all that? And I know that it did. So tell us about the work you were doing prior to, and of course now what you're doing today, and how different are those two aspects of Mel Greenberg's life?
Well, at that time, I had been a producer and writer in radio and television, and I chose to stop working when I had children. I was a full-time mom, and I felt blessed to be able to make that choice, and it was absolutely my decision. And so my first son was going to be a senior. It was his going into his senior year of high school, so I was dealing with him heading off to his future. My youngest son would be entering high school. And so I was, you know, involved in all the things that I was involved in. I was on charity boards. I was very involved in our community and my son's schools. And so a lot of that didn't change. But during the time through it and after, what did change was my deciding to truly focus on what matters. I didn't have to be all things to all people, whether it was to my family or my community. I actually removed myself from a lot of community participation while I worked through this. And then what went along with that was the impending empty nest that was coming. And I didn't think of it then. It certainly wasn't as much a topic of conversation as it is now, even the short time ago that was. But that played into it emotionally. So I think almost more emotionally what I went through were the changes. I didn't notice a lot of changes physically. I was very lucky. However, emotionally, on top of the empowerment that I felt with how I dealt with it and I moved on and yes, 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 I've got this, I was losing everything around me as my children were leaving, and I wasn't sure what that was going to look like. And ultimately, I tried some things that didn't work out, and I tried some things that did. And what I went back to was writing, which had always been my life passion. It had been my work, but in a very different way. And I wrote a novel that was published this past year. It's fiction, it's a series, and it focuses on a woman dealing with just this thing, which is how do we move forward in our lives once the job that we had of 20 years of raising our children is over, and regaining our voice. And it kind of all played back into getting cancer, because that was also about taking back my life and finding my voice. And through writing, I've done just that. And I am here today, so much stronger and so much happier, and kind of so much less connected to what doesn't matter. And maybe that is my, it really, the clarity that comes from the vagueness of not knowing whether you're going to live or die is tremendous. And if you can embrace that, you really do come out happier, better off. And that's why I view it all as a blessing.
In his foreword, Bernie Siegel has a poem at the end of his foreword. It's called The Great Teacher. And it goes like this. Death, what a great teacher you are. Yet few of us elect to take your class and learn about life. That is the essence of death's teaching. Death is not an elective. We must all take the class. The wise students audit the class in their early years and find enlightenment. They are prepared when graduation day comes. It is your commencement. And I have to quote my father, wonderful man, and I consider him pretty wise in some of the things that he shared with me. But one in particular was, he said, eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because yep. Nobody gets out of this world alive.
I say that all the time. I love that. It's so true.
So I'm very appreciative. And I remember saying that to him. I remember saying, you know, I talk about you all the time on the program. He's 88 this year and still going strong. And I told him, I says, yeah, I tell him, oh, yeah, my dad, very wise guy. He says, well, I don't know how wise I am, but thank you.
Yeah, it's true. That's awesome.
I remember asking him at the age of 70, we were sitting around the dinner table celebrating his birthday. And I said, so, Dad, what's it like to be, how do you feel about being 70? And he says, well, two things. One is I didn't expect to live this long. And two, I'm glad I'm here. And he's now 18 years older and still going strong, and a big family around him. And my mother as well. She's 85. And
that's
again,
awesome.
They're still doing great and going strong. And I'm very happy. But I also know, too, that someday I will get that call. I will get that call from one of my sisters who will tell me mom and or dad have passed. And I have no idea how I'm going to react to that. And yet I consider my parents not parents anymore. I consider them very good friends.
Yes.
I've even interviewed them on this program.
I love that.
And after their passing, it will be available for the public to listen to, because my mother told me I was not allowed to release it to the public until then. But nonetheless, this is one of the things that we all are challenged with, this finite mortality. And of course, we say mortality, that's finite. But yet the real true part of us, and I'd love for you to expand on this, the essence of who we really are is immortal. Was that something that you were able to grasp in this period and say, you know, okay, I want the physical body to go on, but even if it doesn't, this isn't the end for me. I'm still going to do whatever it is that I want to do.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And I will quote, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember the quote exactly, but I use this often on my platforms. There's a saying, the question is, am I am who I am, what I am, how I am today because my mother lived or because my mother died? And when I read that, it is both. And I love that because it's true. Because, you know, we have no choice. Again, my husband's mother had a tough, long, beautifully fought battle, though, with lung cancer. And I was blessed that my children grew up with both his parents alive. Mine were passed. And when she got diagnosed, she told my kids, she told all of us, she said, you know, and she was a nurse, and she said, everybody dies. I just now have my number. I know a bit, I know kind of when it's going to happen. And most of us don't. And so if you choose to live that way, it carries with you, and it's how you spend each day. And so with regard to your question, absolutely, I believe the essence of anyone that passes and is with us always. And that's, I share that with my children. I see my mother in them. I see my mother in me, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. And I'm so grateful for that. And I know that I will, what I have imparted to my children and to those who love me and those who don't, my impact in their lives will carry on. So I do believe that our grace is always with us, whether we are here physically or not. We are not a soul. We are a body, and our soul will carry on forever, I believe.
Well, I know that as I move forward in my life, and I am a scant 59 years old.
Oh, me too. cheers to the end of the 50s. Right?
Absolutely. I actually take a line from John Denver's song where he says, it turns me on to think of growing old. And of course, he sang that song probably in his late 20s, early 30s, and only made it to, I think it was 53, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yes, he was.
And broke my heart, I have to tell you. He was one of my favorites. And of course, three out of the four of my favorites have passed on, John Denver, Harry Chapin, and Dan Fogelberg. And I listen to their music all the time. And what really astounds me is the fact that the lyrics are as applicable today as they were when they were originally released, which is gratifying and scary at the same time. But I've only been here 59 years. My dad is 88, right? So he's been here a good almost 30 years more than me. And I know he's just as frustrated as I am. And he's lived 30 more years than me. And so when I think about the way the world is, one of the thoughts that has come to me as you and I have been chatting is, what is your take? And now we're talking here about the mortal, transitory world in which we live. What's going on with this thing that we have labeled cancer? Why is it that it seems like every other person you meet has it in some form or had it in some form? It's as if, you know, some people are more worried about Ebola, I should say, or the flu or some other contaminant. And I'm sitting here going, I don't know. I'm thinking maybe cancer is even worse from the standpoint that it's like every other person seems to have it.
Well, two things. I think of Bob Seger's song, I Wish I Didn't Know Then What I Didn't Know Now.
Uh-huh.
And my oldest son asked me this when I was going through my treatment. He's like, everyone, because a lot of his friends' parents, you know, mothers were going through similar things. And he's like, everywhere I turn, I feel like somebody has, you know, cancer. And the fact that I was diagnosed at it was 0 to 1 stage. It was so early because I was obsessively because of my history. I have been getting mammograms since I was 26. And I think, you know, scientifically, medically, we are advancing every day. And what we know is advancing every day, that perhaps this did exist, but we didn't know what it was. Or when we caught it, as in like my mother's case, it was so much more advanced that the treatment and the outcome was vastly different than it is today. And it's almost more like a chronic illness now than a death sentence for most. I mean, obviously there are different cases, but in fact, to give you an example, and I was young, my mother was diagnosed, I was just 13 years old. And what I remember was the word estrogen receptive, and that being a horrible, horrible thing. And that is actually what progressed through her so quickly, and there was no treatment, and she died very quickly. That's exactly what I had, and that's actually what you want to have now, because that's what tamoxifen treats. So it's actually a positive thing. So 40 years later, it's a good thing. So that's how much we've advanced and where we've come. And I really think that, I don't know that there's more of it or less of it. I'm sure environmental, I do believe that the hormones in our foods is not a good thing. And there are so many negative things going on in our world environmentally and how we eat, in, especially in this country. But I also think that perhaps a lot of it did exist before and we just didn't know what it was.
I thought of that too. I thought that maybe the plethora of cancers that are out there were actually called something else before they were put into that category. And of course, one of the things that I've talked with oncologists and other scientists about is the study of the cancer cells from the standpoint of looking at the characteristics thereof, and what little I know about this from a scientific, biological, and medical perspective, is that they have this attribute to them that causes them to survive. I mean, it's just unbelievable how they...
Oh, I know.
Okay? Now, yeah. What if we were able to tap into that survival aspect of these cancer cells to the stem cell research or regenerative tissues and so on and so forth. And of course, I have been told that, oh, yeah, that study is also going on. In addition to trying to cure these things, get rid of them. Yeah, we're studying this characteristic and other aspects of the cancer cells. I mean, think about it. Isn't it true that when they first started coming out with the different vaccines for the different conditions, they were actually using, they say they were using a small portion of the dead cells of that particular, like chickenpox or measles or something like that, or even the flu, so that our antibodies could look at them and say, okay, we got to kill this. It's already dead, but we're going to marshal up and we're going to get the weapons that we need to fight this along with all of the other weapons we have so that this host can continue on. So I find that really fascinating as far as the research that's going on in all of these different areas, not just trying to get rid of it. But at the same time, I'm wondering from a metaphysical standpoint, if you've addressed this, do you know why subconsciously you acquired, again, trying to put some kind of terminology to this, why you acquired cancer? What was the lesson that you were needing to learn?
Oh, that's a loaded gun.
And now it's in your hands.
I know. Thank you very much. I'm going now. you know, I honestly, for me, it was Jesus. Metaphysically and spiritually and not so much. And realistically, I think that it gave me, or I allowed it to show me, maybe is a better way to say this, what was wrong in my day to day and what had been wrong for so long. And I think everybody's lesson is vastly different. And so whatever, like for me, it was this incredible anxiety that developed that I was going to die, just like my mom did. That's it. You know, so whatever I did, I was just waiting for that moment when it happened. And then when it actually happened, I was like, oh, okay, well, this isn't so bad now. This has happened. I'm going to do this. And then, so my lesson was that anything in my life, I was ultimately in control of, even the things that you have absolutely no control over. And it's what you choose, how you choose, and why you choose to process anything in a certain way. And I always thought I was a really positive person. And in every other aspect of my life, I was. But with that one little fear of death, and I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, addressing this mortality issue and the fact that we don't get out of this life alive. And, you know, none of that mattered anymore. It's like, okay, yeah, ultimately, I will die just like everybody else. Maybe like she did, maybe not. So my choice is now how I live with this beautiful life I've been given and what I choose to do with these days. And the irony in this conversation you and I are having is that when my youngest son was being recruited to play football in high school, he was going through a lot of anxiety with the choices at hand and making the right choice and everything else. And my husband asked me, he's like, you know this better than anyone and you can talk to him more authentically about the process. And I shared with him exactly what I've just shared with you all. about what I went through most of my adult life. Mm-hmm. And you could see the cloud lift from him. And I was so happy. Again, we talked about sharing and souls living on in a different way. I shared with him. My mother was coming through me, helping with her story, sharing it with him, passing it on to another generation, so that now an 18-year-old maybe won't spend the next 40 years in that capacity. And I see it now. He hasn't. He's totally moved on beyond that. So that last life lesson learned, next page.
Hmm. There's another word, a single word that you reference, especially at your website, which is, by the way, folks, melmediallc.com. Want you to go there and check her out and see what she has available for you. But there's one word that you use, and I find this interesting. I'm always intrigued by those people who are recovering from especially addictive behaviors, and they go to the various anonymous groups, and they will say until probably their dying day that they are recovering, whatever it is. They're recovering this, that, or the other. In your case, in the case of many other folks, they use the word surviving. They are a survivor of. They are a survivor. It's like, okay, is there ever going to come a point when you're no longer a survivor? You've reached that milestone, kind of like what we kind of spoke of at the front end of the program about how long it's been, 10 years since your diagnosis. And the aspect of just being a human being, just living your life.
Yeah. And I use it in that way because I don't like that term. I mean, what other choice do you have? Whatever is given, you know, whatever happens in your life, we're all surviving every day. Whether it's, you know, traffic hour and a crummy driver behind us or a bad phone call or, you know, our clothes don't look, whatever, bad hair day, we're all surviving something. So I just don't love that term. I you know, we're living. And that is surviving. We're all surviving. We're all survivors until we're not.
Until we're not. And I do understand that. And one of the things, though, that we are striving for through this program is to go from the state of just survival mode to, and this is the word I've coined, to thrival mode.
Love it. I love that.
You know, it's like, oh, come on. I'm tired of struggling. And just as one example, I know that a lot of people are tired of struggling and living from paycheck to paycheck and just doing this and that and the other and feeling as though they're trapped. We even had a guest on not too long ago talking about the freedom formula and getting untrapped, if you will, and realizing that no matter where you are, you always have other choices. The question is, do you know about them? And that's what we try to put forth here on this program. So did you feel trapped with this diagnosis at that particular point in time before you, so to speak, freed yourself from the survival mode and said, look, this is just my life?
No, I did not feel trapped. I felt free. And for that, exactly what you said, this is my life. So that was another day. It happened. And now how am I going to live the next days of my life? So I didn't feel as though it was entrapment. It was engagement and liberation for me. And I genuinely felt that. And I never really considered how those feelings came across to other people until I was nearing the end of my radiation, and my radiation oncologist told me that I'd become personally her poster child because she could see almost the joy in my life transform over those 7.5 weeks, and she knew that I truly was grateful. Whatever happened, I'm grateful for this day. If I don't get tomorrow, I'm okay, because this day was really awesome. And I still, 10 years out, you kind of start to fall back into life. And I do work to not let those little things bother me and choose to find the joy. And I actually wrote about this yesterday on Instagram, that it is a feeling of choice. And that is the most empowering thing that we have, how we deal with what we are given. Is more important than what we are what we is thrown at us, not what we are given, but what we get, how we deal with it, I think matters more in our lives than what it is.
I would agree with you, and it's just fascinating. Now, I, for myself, this is, and again, I only put this on myself whenever I share. I remember once I was driving in a convertible with this one gal. She was actually my first general manager in radio. And we were just chatting away, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Of course, I didn't know my audience that well at that point. And I made a comment about divorce, not knowing that she had been divorced. And it's like, oops, you know? But we were fine. But it's one of those things where I that's why I now say, okay, what I'm about to say is for me and me alone. If you'd like to use it, borrow it, what have you, go right ahead. But I was born legally blind. And once I got through the bullying phase in grade school, got into high school and so forth, I began to look at it differently and I began to refer to it as a perceived limitation. It's only a limitation if I choose to make it one.
Exactly.
And I had an experience at one of my jobs where I was doing my job, having a great time doing it and doing it well. And I whipped out my magnifying glass to read something, see something, what have you. And the people around me didn't know. They had never seen me pull out a magnifying glass. All they saw me was doing my job. And they said, oh, I didn't know that you needed a magnifying glass. Oh, yeah, I'm legally blind. Really? And it was epitomized by my neighbor, who is my same age. We grew up together. A Catholic family living next door to a Mormon family. We were the Catholic family. They had 9 kids. We had 6. I'm not sure there was a competition going on, but they won. And I recently reconnected with his brother, who then, of course, let him know that, hey, we've reconnected, da 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 da. And he passed on a message through his brother to me that basically summarized, says, you know, I never really thought of him as having a blindness or a disability. But what he showed me was just how an individual with a disability can function normally. Because, you know, he was out there playing with us and running around and playing football and kickball and hide and seek and all those kinds of things in the neighborhood. And you never would have known. So it's shown me given me a whole new respect. I wasn't even trying. I was just being me. I was just like you, just living my life.
Yeah.
So what about that in terms of perceived limitation?
Well, I'm sorry. What was your question?
In terms of viewing both cancer or any other, we'll call them conditions, okay, that we face throughout our lives, they are only limitations if we perceive them as limitations.
Oh, I 100% agree with you on that. And I will share a very personal part of this story. My annual mammograms were every May, like clockwork, never missed one. Well, that year, 2009, in May, I had breast implants put in. So I had to wait a few weeks to have my mammogram. And it was at that time that I was diagnosed. And there's a little irony in that because my mother's birthday was July 14th, July 22nd. She passed on July 14th before her 50th birthday. I went in for my mammogram on the 17th, which is a family number. I was called back on the 22nd for my diagnosis, which would have been her birthday, well, which was her birthday. But so immediately there was speculation, oh, do you think it's because you had the implants? And I thought, well, no, actually, that's a good thing because I had to wait. And it was so tiny. It was not even the size of your tiny fingernail. And it was pushed to the front because of the implants. I would have gotten my mammogram at the regular time. It would have been growing in me for a year. So who knows what would have happened. And I would not have had, the timing would have just all been different. Then on top of that, I'm of Jewish descent. Because we're Eastern European, I had the BRCA testing because I felt if that was positive, my mother's the only female in the family that had breast cancer, but she could still carry the gene, which means I could carry it. So I did all the genetic testing and my decision with my husband that I spoke, you know, we talked about it together and he supported my decision. If I had it, I would obviously have double mastectomy. That was not an issue. And I kind of joked about it. And I said, well, they're fake anyway. I don't care. Maybe I'll make them a little bigger. It was, you know, I just kind of took it lightly. It was perceived. It wasn't negative. I did not have the genes I chose not to have a mastectomy because my oncologist, at her guidance, you know, there's no magic wall where they know they've gotten all the cells. And it's a false sense of security. And I thought, well, just like this happened and it was meant to be, if I do it this way, this is my journey. This is what's going to happen. So I didn't even worry about my choice. And that was maybe back to your earlier question. I don't second guess myself as much anymore. I'm like, this is okay, because this is what it is now. And this is the right choice. And this is my life and my, you know, choices based on the information I have today. All that can change tomorrow, just like our knowledge and where we are medically with our cancer diagnosis and treatment, where we've come in 40 years. Everything's changing day to day. And I choose kind of to live my life that fluidly as well, not in terms of just negating that I don't have a future, but more so, which I used to do. And I think maybe that answers your earlier question the best. I used to think, I'm going to die anyway, so I better live the heck out of today, regardless of anything. And I think that line was more clearly defined for me with my diagnosis, because yes, you don't know if you have tomorrow, but how you choose to live today doesn't mean that all bets off, just no responsibility, no care in the world. More so, you care in a different way, and you are absolutely more present to everyone around you. That matters, the people close to you that you love, and yourself, and you are more honorable to yourself.
Well, I know that, well, I don't know this. I do know that there will be certain conditions, if you will, that will come about in my life in the next 40 years. And I say next 40 because I have plans on living to be at least 100, because I have to outlive my great-grandmother who lived to be 100.
Yay!
And that's my plan anyway. Now, what the universe has planned, I have no idea. And right. You know what? If today were my day, I would be okay with that. Now, do I have other things I still want to do? Sure. Would I miss being with family and friends and my wife and so forth? Absolutely. Yeah. But I think, I'm wondering, have you made peace in that sense where you say, look, if today's the day, okay, then today's the day. And there's nothing you can do about it anyway. I mean, I think about that. I think about that in terms of alien abduction, and people want to protect themselves. And I'm going, look, you can't stop them. So you might try to look at it from a different perspective as a new experience that you might learn something from it, because you can't stop it anyway. So with death, you can't stop it. It's coming. We're all going to have it. That, again, we're going to take that master's class eventually, and we're going to have our commencement ceremony. What about you? Are you good to go today?
Oh my gosh. I love that you asked that question and that you feel that way. Yes, I am. And exactly what you said. Are there things I want to do? Yes. Well, are there things I will miss? Yes, absolutely, in this physical world. But I'm okay. I'm. If it happens, it's my time. It's the universe saying you have other things to do now somewhere else. I'm good with that. And I'm good with who I leave myself, my legacy. And I'm good with everyone close to me, my children. Yeah. And you miss them physically, but I would be okay. Sad. I mean, you know, that's a tricky question to answer, because I don't know anyone that really wants to go, and it's never okay, but I would be okay. I'm looking outside right now. I've got a really windy day here in the desert, and I'm watching these trees, wind blown. I'm like, you know, I would be okay.
Yeah,
I would.
And, yeah. You know, and again, as I said before, and you've said it, people say it all the time, it's going to happen. I know that there are people who hope that, and of course, I don't know what the statistics would be. I'm sure they're kept somewhere, somehow, between the type of statistics of those who go peacefully, maybe in their sleep, or they just lay their head down and they leave, as opposed to those who, unfortunately, would leave through some other traumatic, dramatic way. I certainly would like to. I remember, I don't know how you feel about reincarnation, but there's this process called life between lives that I went through. It took me back to my last lifetime before this one. I got to tell you, I liked it. I thought that was a pretty neat life. I was a pioneer, a farmer, had cattle, Lost my barn in a big old fire. I also had a cabin up in the mountains, which is where I wound up at the end. I went out on the porch, sat in my chair, put my feet up on the railing. I said, that's a good life. Laid my head back, tipped my hat forward, laid my head back, and I went.
And that's awesome.
And it's like, man, can I do that again? That's how I want to go.
I'm going to have to look up this. I'll talk to you afterwards. I want to find out about this. I would love to do that.
We have a practitioner here in Santa Barbara that I am good friends with as well. He's been on the program. His name is Peter Wright. And it's regarding this. Dr. Newman is his name. And he is the one who's done a lot of this research into life between lives and what goes on between the lifetimes. It's just fascinating work that he's done. I've read both two of his books. And then I'm also reading this book. I've had this book since I was 21, and I carry it with me just about everywhere I go. It's called The Impersonal Life. And in there's a chapter talking about reincarnation. Now, this book is written from the standpoint of God talking to you. And basically, it says, you know, you think that, you know, you go through a past life regression, and you think you've lived multiple lives throughout the centuries. When in fact, all you're doing when you're doing a past life regression is you're tapping into the manifestation of other individuals who have lived down through the centuries. Well, the thought occurred to me, well, does this really make that much of a difference? And what I realized was when you tap into whether it's past lives you've lived or the lives of people who've lived before you, isn't the point to learn something for this lifetime?
Yes.
So really nothing changes as far as that's concerned. So whether it's been past lives or we're just tapping into the lives of others who have lived before us to learn something, that's really the point. But I do find it fascinating. And I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people, whether you do past life regression, if you get an opportunity to do the life between life regression, hypnosis, you know, it's the whole point is to learn something about yourself.
Absolutely. It's such an incredible journey.
Yeah. And I certainly encourage, and I'll certainly pass on this information to you when we finish up here.
Great, thank you.
But it's just a remarkable experience. And that's one of the things that I have been gleaning from people over the years I've been interviewing is the aspect of knowing who you really are. I forget who said, know thyself. I know I love people who are saying, oh yeah, Socrates said this and Plato said that. And it's like, all I remember are the quotes, which to me are more important than who said them.
Right.
But what was your insight into Mel Goldberg? I beg your pardon, Greenberg, that surprised you or lifted you up, that you learned about yourself through this process?
Oh, gosh. That surprised me that...
Or shocked you, or going, oh, my God, that's not me.
Well, I think that the fact that I looked back over my life and I thought the choices I had made and things I had done and what I thought were my only choices, I thought, wow, why did I took the paths that I took in my life. And I still wonder about that sometimes. And I think that I question everything around me a bit on a much deeper level now, not in a negative way, but I look to understand more. And I think before I was much less tolerant, a bit more, and maybe that's youth too, ideological, that you know things are very black and white, and if you're this, you must be this, and if you do this, you must be this, and. I'm far more accepting now. And I think, wow, why was I ever so much like that? And I didn't think I was, but as I look back, I absolutely was. And, you know, everybody is just trying to figure it out. And I'm far more calm and respectful of everyone's choices because of the choices that I had to make. And I think it's very easy to sit back and say, well, you should do this or you should be this. And or because you did this, this, you know, if this, then that. And it's never quite that clear. And actually, that was sort of the impetus for the title of my novel, Running With Our Eyes Closed, because I feel like that's what everybody's doing, you know, to their best ability. And so that was maybe my aha moment in going through my process of having cancer and getting through it. And the past decade was being more appreciative of the fact that everybody's way of doing things is what's right for them. And, you know, unless there's no malice. And when there is, obviously, you take that into account. But for the most part, most people act without malice. They are just trying to live their lives the best way they can and for those people around them that they love. And I find myself being far more accepting of that. And I think that's one of the things I'm most grateful for in my journey with cancer, because everything that came from that and between, it was a perfect storm for me. It was getting cancer. It was becoming an empty nester. It was trying to figure out my next steps in my life again, all at once, and stumbling along the way. And I think that I look back now and that would be my takeaway moment, that I now can be far more appreciative and patient and accepting and loving to everyone's process.
And I think that's part of what we are doing here. We are hoping that people can understand where other people are coming from, but maybe more importantly, understand where they are coming from. Because as you, I like the example of running with your eyes closed. You don't see where you're going, but you also don't see truly what you're doing and why. And when we begin to understand that, you know, it makes a big difference. I love some of these programs that I've watched where I realize that the program would only be 5 minutes long if they did at the front end of the program what they do near the end of the program, and that is talk. I still remember watching Batman versus Superman, the movie. I don't know if you've ever seen that one or not, but we were watching it, and of course, there's this conflict, this drama between Batman and Superman. And I can't honestly remember from the beginning of the movie what the heck the drama was about, but it wasn't until the end of the movie when they finally stopped their fighting and they started talking and realizing that there had been a misperception of a particular event that had happened at the beginning of the movie. Yeah. That had they talked first.
Yeah, but then where's the conflict?
Then where's the movie? And where's the movie? So I get that, but it's like, come on, let's, you know, we need to talk to ourselves. We need to talk to the divine, whatever that, and we need to talk to each other, because it's just astounding what we're missing and how much drama we're creating in our lives that we really don't need to, we can focus our energies on much more important things like thriving, like finding those new ways of living through the processes, for example, that you and the other contributors to Chaos to Clarity have put together. And I thank you so much for doing that. Chaos to Clarity is the book we're talking about. It's a compendium of, I want to say essays, but it's stories. They're transformational change is what we're talking about with real people, real pain, real hopelessness, and real healing. And before we let you go, I want to thank you so much for giving us so much time here on the program. And I encourage our listeners to go to the podcast because you're going to hear a whole lot more than just the 50 minutes that we do for the radio program. But I want to ask you three final questions, but also invite you, should you find yourself out here in Santa Barbara, you're not far, Tucson, you know?
Yeah, I love Santa Barbara.
Although I'll be in Phoenix in December, so. But we'd love to continue this conversation. I think that because we really haven't gotten into the work that you're doing today on your website, melmediallc.com, which we'll be sending people to. We'll link to that website so people can go there and get more information about you. But I have three final questions for you before we let you go, and they are as follows. You may have addressed them during the interview, but I'd like to ask them straightforward. Who is Mel Greenberg?
Oh, she is a woman who is excited about the future. At almost turning 60 in January, I will be 60. And she is a mother, and I am a very proud mom. And she's a wife. I love my family. And so family is a man. I'm a family woman. Maybe that's a nice way to phrase it. And I'm someone who is just hopelessly hopeful and in love with life.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to bring more to the forefront the ability and the need for women midlife and on to connect and have community and to know that you're all going through times of change and questioning, and you don't have to be alone. And in a world where we are so electronically connected, we are becoming more and more isolated. And I'm working to build the platform to create community and opportunity to express and learn and share those feelings and provide information and grow at this time in our lives.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I don't know that I can answer that. My greatest joy, I will tell you, has been and is being a mother. My purpose, I think, is to solely share my energy and my spirit and my love. I used to worry that I didn't have a collection, you know, and especially now there's a thing out there with like all this tribe of women, and I don't have this huge group of women that I'm super, super close to, although I actually have more now, but I didn't. And I used to think there was something wrong with me, or why didn't I have this massive group of people? And then I realized you don't need a massive group. You need people who energize you and connect with you and who you support with each other. So I think that is my purpose, to leave my mark in a way that empowers people to find it in themselves.
Well, I want to thank you so much for giving us this time. I think this has just been fantastic, and I encourage people to get a copy of Chaos to Clarity, and we are going to be having a series of interviews of programs here on Tell Me Your Story, focusing on these stories. I think that they're important, and that's the reason why we're going to be doing a series of probably 10 or 12 interviews that are going to focus on different aspects of the challenges, the circumstances, if you will, or as I like to call them, Mel, the coincidences that happen in our lives help us to grow, help us to transform our lives, and to face the one dirty word in the universe that nobody likes, and that is change. It is the one constant in the universe. We need to embrace it. We need to accept it. We need to incorporate it into our lives. And sometimes I think that we need to make change happen for the sake of making change happen, so that we sort of make it the norm instead of the static status quo that everybody seems to think is the best way to go. And to that end, we'll be bringing you a different guests who have participated in this compendium. And I thank you, Mel, for participating in this book, Chaos to Clarity. And I thank you for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story.
Thank you so much. It was just such a pleasure. I loved all your insights, and I appreciate the opportunity to share both my story and the upcoming release of From Chaos to Clarity. It's been an incredible, incredible moment.
Absolutely. And we will be linked to your website, which is melmediallc.com. And I thank you again. And I thank you for listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, this special series on Chaos to Clarity here on this program, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Be sure to listen to the podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, and Blueberry, and many, many others. And until next time, love to love.